A lot of people ask the question, where's the line? How far is too far? You know, is one beer okay, but two beers is not okay? Is a little bit of innocent flirting okay, but is this now across the border to sexual morality? Where's the line? Wrong question.
Welcome to The God-Centered Life with Josh Moody. We're looking at the book of Joshua today, chapter 1, verse 1. You're on a mission. Josh Moody is senior pastor of College Church in Wheaton, Illinois, and I'm Todd Busty. Well, Josh, we'll be studying four forgotten truths about God's people in the book of Joshua. So set the study up for us.
Yeah, sure. So Joshua obviously is leading God's people into the promised land. But the story is, of course, written after that time, and it's written precisely to teach God's people to remember that he is faithful in their battles. And hence we've called this four forgotten truths. It's so easy to forget these things. And the book of Joshua reminds us these great truths that will enable us also to fight our spiritual battles victoriously.
Fantastic. They fought battles. We fight battles. Let's get to it. Joshua chapter 1. You're on a mission. Here's Josh.
Well, go ahead and keep your Bibles open to the book of Joshua. We're beginning a new series today in that book. And we've called it the four forgotten truths of about God's people from the book of Joshua. The book of Joshua is actually divided into four different sections. So there's chapters 1 to 5 that is all about the entrance into the promised land as God leads his people through his servant Joshua into the promised land and their initial battles and all that sort of thing, chapters 1 to 5. And then chapter 6 to 12 is really a great list of all the conquests and the battles and all the rest. And then, so that's the second section. The third section, 13 through to 22, chapters 13 to 22, is a great catalog of places and names and sort of geographical details. And frankly, when you read it these days, it can seem boring. It's like, why is that all in the Bible? But what you've got to understand is, imagine if you were a part of Israel, and that is a record of how God has given you the land, that all that he has promised has come true, that he has been faithful. And you see, part of one of the big themes of the book of Joshua is the faithfulness of God, that he said it, he promised it, and he did it. And I don't know what you're going through these days. There may be something where you're wondering, is God truly going to be faithful to me? Can I actually trust that he will do what he said he would do? And here's the book of Joshua, and this list of different areas and places that he promised that he would give to God's people, and he did. And he will keep his promises to you too. So that's the third section. And then the final section, chapters 23 and 24, are Joshua's final word to the people. They're his sermon to the people. And in that message, he's basically calling upon God's people to make a choice. Choose this day whom you will serve. Will you serve God or will you not serve God? He's calling on them to make a choice. Will you be faithful to the God who has been faithful to you? And he presents that to them. As I say, the series that we're beginning is called The Four Forgotten Truths About God's People. And we're going to look at those four truths over the next 4 weeks. The story so far in Joshua is that God had promised to Abraham that his descendants would inherit the promised land. And he had told Abraham there would come a time, as indeed happened, where his descendants would go into slavery into Egypt. And they were there for a long time. And then God, according to his promise, rescued his people from Egypt through the hand of his servant Moses. But now, so that's the backstory, now Moses is dead. And God's people are camped on the other side of the Jordan. And now it's up to Joshua, Moses' assistant, to lead them across the Jordan into the promised land. So that's the drama of the moment that we're in as we begin this book of Joshua. And the first of these four forgotten truths, we'll see why I've called them forgotten as we go through this series and through this sermon. It's intended to remind God's people who they are and what their purpose is, lest they forget, lest we forget. The first of these four forgotten truths about God's people is that we are on a mission. You are on a mission. We are on a mission. You see, it's often been observed that the book of Joshua has a parallel book in the New Testament, a companion book, a parallel book, a book that is kind of like Joshua in the New Testament. And that book is the book of Acts. Just as God's people were told to go into the promised land and to inherit the land that God had given them, so we as the New Testament people of God are told to go, therefore, and make disciples of all nations. And the book of Acts describes the beginning of that as the message of the gospel goes from Jerusalem to Judea to Samaria to the ends of the earth. And we enter the land not with a physical sword, but with the sword of the Spirit of the gospel. And it's a call, therefore, to mission. You're on a mission. We, as God's people, are on a mission. And this first passage here, that's the first of the four forgotten truths that is about we're on a mission, has two parts to it. It's structured in two sections, and there are two parts of the sermon. And if you're taking notes, here they are. First, the place of mission, and then second, the power for mission. So the place of mission, and then the power for mission. And the place of mission is verses 1 to 6, and the power for mission, it sort of overlaps in verse 6, the structure of this message from God to Joshua. Then the power for mission is from verse 6 to the end of this message from God to Joshua in verse 9. So the place of mission, and then the power for mission. First, the place of mission. So you're on a mission. To where? What's the place of mission? Here it is, verse 2. Moses, my servant, is dead. This is the backstory. Now, therefore, arise, go over this Jordan, you and all the people, into the land. So this is the place. And then emphasize, as the place is described over and over again here, you'll see this, is that the land is a gift. Into the land that I am giving to them, to the people of Israel. You see, when God had first announced the promised land to Abraham, he said, I'm going to give you this land. And again, here it is, into the land that I'm giving to them. And then is described the various parts of this land. Verse 3, every place that the sole of your foot will tread upon, I have, again, notice, given to you, just as I promised to Moses. And then verse 4, the sort of geographical boundaries of the land are described. From the wilderness and this Lebanon, as far as the great river, the river Euphrates, all the land of the Hittites, to the great sea, toward the going down of the sun, shall be your territory. No man shall... And then verse 5 and 6 begins again to the power for mission. As I say, it's an overlap, but that power for mission is exposited by, explained by the Lord more in the second half. But no man shall be able to stand before you all the days of your life, just as I was with Moses. I'll be with you, I'll not leave you or forsake you. Be strong and courageous. This is the power for mission that we'll look at more in a moment. Here is the place. For you shall cause this people to inherit the land that I swore to their fathers to give them. So that the place is a gift is emphasized over and over again. Now, before I apply that for us today as God's New Testament people, it is important that we deal with a couple of common objections to the book of Joshua.
Josh will shed some light on what those objections are in just a moment. But first, wanted to let you know that Josh is senior pastor of College Church in Wheaton, Illinois. And the program you're listening to is God-Centered Life. If you're just joining us, we're glad you're here. We've been working our way through the Bible, various places at various times, and all of those studies are available for you online. We'll tell you how you can access those in just a few minutes. Meantime, back into our study at the beginning of Joshua. Here's Josh.
First of all, people often say today that the book of Joshua and the story that describes is deeply unfair. It's not right. It was the Canaanite land. Why were they chucked out? How's that fair? What is more, when you read the accounts in Joshua, it sounds like, well, several times it says that they went in and they totally destroyed the people. And it begins to sound like, well, genocide? How's that right? How could the holy God do that? So how do we answer this common objection today? Well, first of all, it's important to remember that God is God. And that to question God is itself a risky proposition. Nonetheless, what God does should reflect the character of God that God reveals. So how do we answer this question? Well, first of all, but it's important to remember who the Canaanites were by this stage. The Canaanites had given in to the worst kinds of abusive sexual immorality. You can read about it in Leviticus 18. And not only that, they had developed a practice of child sacrifice. And you can read about that in Deuteronomy chapter 12. So here are the Canaanites. Deeply abusive sexual immorality being practiced and killing their children, child sacrifice. What is more, God says through Joshua to the people that if they, as they enter this land, if they take on the practices of the Canaanites and become like the Canaanites, they too, the Israelites, will be expelled from the land, as indeed happened. And those descriptions of total destruction are hyperbole. They are exaggeration to make a point. And you can read that in the text, because when it says they were totally destroyed, right after it would say, make sure you don't intermarry with them. Well, you can't intermarry with people who are dead. So what is being said by the total destruction, this is hyperbole, exaggeration of effect, what is being said is their authority over the land has gone. So this is not a description of God's unfairness. This is a description of the holy God who will take a stand against evil. And of course, the Old Testament description of the wrath of God against injustice and evil is a mere precursor to the final judgment of God you read about in the book of Revelation. The grossest kinds of sexual abusive immorality, child sacrifice. You know, a few years ago when I read those, I looked at it, you know, Leviticus 18, Deuteronomy 12, you read that and you think, well, that's awful. How could that possibly happen? And now, you know, when I read Leviticus 18, Deuteronomy 12, I say to myself, sounds scarily familiar. I'm told you just have to click a couple of buttons on the internet and you can find the grossest abusive kind of sexual immorality and child sacrifice. I mean, we kill a lot of babies. So God's people, we must not become like the Canaanites. And there is a message of warning to any country, any nation, any people that does come like the Canaanites. How long will God's wrath be held in abeyance? How long would he be patient? And the mission, the place of mission, therefore, for us, is not to go in with a physical sword. No, the place of mission is to go with the sword of the Spirit, to win the Canaanites around us to Christ, that they might be rescued from the final judgment to come. So that's the first common objection. Isn't it deeply unfair? No, it's not deeply unfair. It's a description of God's justice, for which we are grateful, because there are great evils in this world. And that when someone commits horrendous evils throughout their life and then they die, we say they got away with it. They didn't get away with it. There is a judgment to come. But the other common objection that people often have to the book of Joshua is simply this, which is, it never happened. The conquest never really took place. How do you answer that one? Yeah, they would say, there's no archaeological evidence that took place. Well, the book you really need to read about that is a book by someone called K.A. Kitchen, who for many years was a professor and then professor emeritus of Egyptology at the University of Liverpool. His book on the reliability of the Old Testament is actually endorsed by one of the members of College Church, who's now gone to be the Lord, someone called Harry Hoffner, who was for many years professor at the University of Chicago. It's a brilliant book, and he dispersed all these myths about the Old Testament, but they're important. So that's the book to read, K.A. Kitchen, because you know, if you go to that source of all contemporary wisdom and knowledge today, Wikipedia, and just read what it says about the conquest, it will tell you, you know, basically no modern scholar believes it, and that ain't true. And so K.A. Kitchen's the book you need to read, but it's a big book and none of you are going to read it. So let me just give you a little snippet, okay? One of the things he says is that the people who have just become like into the manuscripts, the texts, that kind of scholar, that kind of theologian, but don't step back to actually look at the history, because he was an Egyptologist, that they misunderstand the context. So they'll say there's no archaeological evidence, but hold on a moment. Where did the Israelites live and what kind of people were they? So the Israelites in Egypt lived on what's called the East Delta of the Nile River, and the East, almost certainly, and the East Delta is a mud flat. So nothing's preserved in mud. What is more, the Israelites, they were slaves. They didn't live in palaces with stone. They lived in shacks with beaten down wood. So that there are no archaeological remains is exactly what you would expect to find. And indeed, it is well known that pharaohs, the Egyptian rulers, never recorded any failures. And so that's the record of Israel's escape from Egypt and then entrance into the Promised Land is not recorded by the Egyptian pharaohs, is exactly what you would expect to find. And when you read the accounts, the Egyptian accounts, of the kind of world in which the Israelites would have lived, it is extraordinarily like the world that is described in the Bible. So those are two common objections. It really did happen, and it really is just. Well, then let me apply this, the place of mission, to us. First, just in two simple ways for you. First, individually, and then corporately for us as a church, as a congregation. And just do it, individually. I find a lot of people ask the question about their, you know, about their working life, about their friendship life, about their social life. I find today a lot of people ask the question, where's the line? You know, how far is too far? Where can I go where I'm not a Canaanite, but I'm still a Christian? Where's the line? You know, is one beer okay, but two beers is not okay? Is a little bit of innocent flirting okay, but is this now across the border to sexual morality? Where's the line? Wrong question. The right question is, what's your mission? That just changes the whole mentality. The issue is not where the line is. The issue is, how are you going to reach the people around you? What kind of man do you have to be to raise up children who will love Jesus and will go, yeah, I saw Dad live a certain way. And I know it because he lived that kind of. What kind of man do you have to be to live like that? What kind of mum do you have to be for your children to grow up like that? What kind of business leader do you need to be so that you create an environment around which people can actually believe that the Christianity is true because you live it out day by day, Monday to Friday, and not just Sunday? That's the question. What's your mission? So that's individually. And then corporately, that is for us as a church, you know, 8 o'clock service, 9 o'clock, 9:30 service, 11 o'clock service, 6 o'clock prayer meeting tonight. Us as a church, us as a group. The application, so I would make this, is this. See, a lot of people think of church as a museum. You know, the church has been around a long time. I don't mean this church. I mean church in general. The church has been around a long time, a couple of thousand years. You know, it's fine if you like that kind of old-fashioned stuff. It's a museum for saints. Other people, though, look at church as a market. We have a product, God. And we're trying to market it to the society around us. So we're selling something. Church is like a market. But the trouble with church is just a museum, then it's just out of date, isn't it? It's going to fade away in the end. It's a museum. There's no living power to it. And if church is a market, then in order to sell God, you've got to make compromises because, you know, the people around you might not like this part of the Bible, or this part of morality, or this idea about God. And you've got to shift things around, and before too long, you become a Canaanite. But church is neither a museum nor a market. Church is a mission. Go, therefore, make disciples of all nations. We're on a mission. That's what we're about.
That's Josh Moody, and this is The God-Centered Life. Okay, so we've got this wrong question, right question paradigm. And you say, how close can I get to the line? Wrong question. So how does this play out with, you mentioned, innocent flirting? Where is the line versus what's my mission? How do we apply that paradigm to that situation?
Well, I think we have to take a step back. We have to say, who am I? What am I made for? What is my mission before God? And then we look at our relationships with people of the opposite gender and how we relate to them in an entirely different light. It's not, how close can I get to this line? Is this okay, this relationship? Can I make this joke? Can I get this close to this person? Is this, instead, what we're asking is, how can we as a community be radically sold out for Jesus and witness to him in every possible way so that we can win people for Christ? And then you find you don't even get anywhere close to anything that is spiritually dangerous.
So can we say we want to preserve the unity of the kingdom? We want to do nothing that would cause division within the kingdom so that somebody from the outside looking in sees a unified body regardless of gender and a sense of safety that those of the opposite sex feel safe with us? Is that all part of that equation?
That would be a great part of the equation, yeah. How can we live in a way that we are an attractive community for those who are seeking hope rather than, you know, here's the rule, am I keeping it or not? I mean, it's just the wrong way to think. You are made for a purpose. You have a mission. Go to it. And then all the other aspects of how to live come into line with that overall purpose.
So many ways to apply this what's my mission paradigm. We're going to discuss the power for that mission next time we get together. We hope you're going to join us. Thanks, Josh. So on our website, godcenteredlife.org, Josh has recommended some things that he feels would be helpful in terms of moving you forward in your devotional pursuits. There's studies there, there's devotionals there, various books that he's recommended. There's also an opportunity for you to partner with us if you're able to share a gift of any amount to help us spread gospel-centered teaching to as many ears as possible. We'll say thanks by sending you Tony Evans' book, Winning Your Spiritual Battles. All of that taking place at godcenteredlife.org. Next time we get together, time for a truth check.
See, this is not just pull yourself up by your bootstraps. This is not just when the going gets tough, the tough get going. This is the truth of who Joshua is and who you are if you're a Christian, applied by yourself to yourself.
Continuing our study in the book of Joshua when we get together next time. One more reminder, GodCenteredLife.org, resources for your devotional growth, and this is your invitation to join us for the next edition of The God-Centered Life with Josh Moody.